Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro Libertate Radio, a full-throttle, no-holds-barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Greig. Drop what you're
doing! It's the case in human history that statesmen sometimes form alliances to deal with threats, and occasionally you have nations that have been compelled to go to war in order to justify, or rather in order to deal with problems that threaten them, threaten their very existence. Sometimes statesmen have found it necessary to forge alliances and go to war in order to deal with threats. I think that the people ruling us today create threats to justify alliances and create alliances to facilitate wars. I'm prompted to think so anew by a headline from a recent installment of the Jerusalem Post, which is, I guess you'd have to call this newspaper a neocon organ. It's frequently cited by the Murdochian neocon media nabobs here in the United States and in Great Britain. So we'd have to say that it's broadly analogous to the old Washington Times or some of the other publications. The Wall Street Journal now would have to be considered sort of the flagship of the neocon media alliance. The Jerusalem Post would serve, I think, that role with respect to Israeli policies. The headline is the following. U.S. will attack Iran if it must. Must? I really have a difficult time conjuring in my mind a set of circumstances in which it would be imperative to attack Iran, particularly in light of the fact that we've got a lot on our plate right now. We're not dealing in geopolitical terms as a country with the rest of the world from a position of commanding and prohibitive strength. I mean, we're in the middle, not the middle, actually, we're in the very early phase of the greatest depression. There really is no sticking point between where we are right now and utterly abysmal economic collapse. This has been facilitated, abetted, and accelerated by two completely useless, pointless, stupid wars that are being waged right now that are doing what Madison warned wars always do. They're helping to deplete the treasury. Madison will later know what it would be like to have a treasury depleted by war. The United States was broke. I mean, literally broke. It had no more liquidity. It had no more credit as of December of 1814, December of 1814, just before the peace treaty was signed. That was 1813, 1814. I have to go back and look that up. But just before the peace treaty was signed, ending the war of 1812, it must have been 1814, the treasury was completely depleted. You know, Madison, who 15, 20 years earlier had warned that war is the parent of armies, and these beget debts and taxes, and armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for forcing the many to submit to the will of the few. He talked about the fact in that same warning, Mr. Madison did, that war is a wonderful way to aggrandize executive power, to expand the already substantial ranks of executive branch parasites and sycophants, who, of course, are leeches on the public treasury, parasites battening on the bloodstream of the economy. He warned that it would not be possible for any nation to retain its freedom in the midst of perpetual warfare. So we have two fronts, two active separate wars going on right now under the general rubric of the war against things the government doesn't like, you know, fill in the blank, war on terror, the war on drugs, the war on violent extremism, however you'd characterize the prevailing abstractions to justify this open-ended conflict. And they're talking about opening up another front against a much larger and much wealthier country than either of the two that the United States government selected for the most recent ventures in murderous humanitarianism. Iran is a country that is capable of fighting back, which is one of the reasons why I'm still a little bit skeptical that Washington's actually going to pick a fight with Iran. Historically, Washington's only picked fights with people, regimes, nations, institutions that couldn't fight back. when it has dealt with countries that could fight back, generally speaking, unless it's gotten involved in a war as a latecomer in an existing conflict, think of what happened in 1917 and 1941, by and large, Washington does not do the war thing.
Dealing once again with the prospect of another war, this time with Iran, after 40 or 50 years of unrelenting.
So in a recent visit to Israel, actually, you saw the spectacle of Joseph Lieberman and John McCain and Lindsey Graham saying that there is a consensus to the point of unity, near unity in the Congress, that if it is quote-unquote necessary, the United States is going to attack Iran. What Lieberman said was the following. As quoted in the Jerusalem Post, there is wide support in Congress for using all means to keep Iran from becoming a nuclear power, quote, through diplomatic and economic sanctions if we possibly can, through military actions if we must. Lieberman, flanked at a Jerusalem press conference by his Senate colleagues John McCain and Lindsey Graham, used very tough language, saying the words military action in regards to stopping Iran's nuclear program. Most U.S. officials opt to tiptoe around the subject, saying no options are off the table. By the way, when they say no options are off the table, they're not necessarily meaning to connote that military force would be among the acceptable options. No options means that tactical nuclear strikes might be involved. That's something that was made very plain during both the Republican and Democratic presidential debates leading up to the 2008 election. There was that remarkable spectacle in one of the early Republican debates of just about every Republican presidential contender endorsing the use of tactical nuclear weapons in a preemptive strike against Iran. And Ron Paul, God bless him, got up and said, this is perfectly insane. This is utterly deranged that we're talking about a nuclear strike against a country that's neither harmed nor threatened us. And that to this date, and of course the date we're talking about was 2007, and the expression remains true today, to date we do not know, we cannot confirm in any reliable sense that Iran actually has a nuclear weapons program, let alone a nuclear weapons capacity. Lieberman said that a certain trumpet needs to be sounded here for the Iranian regime to hear. He said the sanctions Congress recently passed, parenthetically, sanctions are an act of war, and this sanctions regime has been expanded to include denial of refueling rights by Iranian civilian aircraft at certain airports. That's, of course, an aggressive act, after a fashion. That the sanctions Congress recently passed against Iran were meant to send a signal to Tehran. We'll talk about the signal that that sends and the likelihood of a war between the United States and Iran after these messages. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397. We'll be right back. I'm still somewhat skeptical about the prospects of an actual shooting war between the United States and Iran, or what would be more likely, some configuration of the United States and Israel versus Iran, because the Treasury is pretty much overextended, the U.S. military is overextended, and historically, Washington does not like to wage wars against opponents who can actually fight back, unless they get involved in a conflict that's already underway, and they jump in after others have borne the initial brunt of the capable opponent's attack. That's what happened in World War I. The United States was a latecomer in 1917. It entered an already pretty much stalemated conflict, and the stalemate really should have been permitted to continue in World War I. There should have been a negotiated end to that conflict. The first Pope Benedict was trying to arrange a negotiated end to World War I, hopefully an end that would resume the status quo ante bellum, where you'd have people withdraw back into their territories and try to resume relations based on commerce and diplomacy, as opposed to these insane self-destructive ventures in military force. Unfortunately, the United States barged into that conflict and joined one side. You ended up with a near, not quite, but a near Carthaginian peace imposed on Germany that helped to cultivate the charming regime that took over in the form of National Socialism. And you had the inquiry redraw the map of the Eurasian landmass in such a way as to guarantee all kinds of stimulating political experiments throughout the Balkans and the Middle East. And we're still dealing with the aftermath almost a century later of the United States, the Wilson regime's stupid, iniquitous decision to intrude in World War I. World War II, of course, had been going on, depending upon where you start the chronology of World War II. There are some that think that in the East it started as early as 1931 with some Imperial Japanese ventures in China. You could say that it had been going on for at least 3 years, maybe 4 years, by the time, maybe 5 years, but at least 3 years by the time the United States got involved post Pearl Harbor, after FDR successfully collaborated with Yamamoto to bring about the attack on Pearl Harbor that provided the pretext for war, and because the United States provided sort of the decisive element toward victory in both of those wars. There's a rather unearned reputation here for martial valor and martial capacity on the part of the regime in Washington, D.C. And I think that in the event that we end up in an actual shooting war with Iran, given the fact that Iraq, although somewhat tranquil right now, has still become a bleeding wound in the treasury, and Afghanistan's becoming something of a second chest wound in terms of military and logistics, I think that if we end up in an actual shooting war with Iran, there's a pretty fair possibility that the United States, unless, of course, the conflict goes nuclear very quickly, is going to get beat. And that's one of the reasons why I remain skeptical. At least I hope that there's going to be something that's going to check rein the demented ambitions of the people in Washington who are obviously, visibly, palpably lusting after a war with Iran. John from Winnipeg, Canada, I believe, is with us on the phone this evening. How are you doing?
Hello, William.
Yes, sir.
Hi. Good sir. Are we on the air or something?
I'm sorry? Yes, yeah, you're on.
John here from Canada calling about your great,
yes,
awesome talk radio program that's currently running.
Thanks so much, John. It's great to hear from you. Are you listening to the program on a radio receiver or on a speaker? Could you turn it down if that's the case? We're getting,
yeah,
a bit of an echo, a bit of feedback here.
Yeah, I'm getting feedback on the phone, but that's okay. Anyway, I was listening to you talk about Lieberman and the situation with Iran, and I mean,
yeah,
we can boil this down. I mean, okay, who's a threat to American liberty here? Lieberman for advancing that Americans should be incarcerated indefinitely without trial? You know,
yeah,
if we wanted to support the Israeli cause, we would demand the arrest of war criminals who broke the truce and got Jews killed for the financial benefit of Netanyahu.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they broke the truce to indiscriminately target, as they don't deny this, children with white phosphorus. You know, they told the children,
yeah,
gather in the city center and you'll be protected. And then what did they do? Set them on fire. You know, they killed 239 police officers whose job was just to defend our communities. You know, why doesn't Lieberman fight for American freedom in Afghanistan, where these soldiers are blindly supporting the dope dealing of heroin into American streets, which earns some young American kids lifetime prison sentences because it's their third felony? I mean, isn't,
yeah,
that an attack against liberty and freedom around the world? I mean, and then, of course, you're a great guy. I don't know how up-to-date you are on this, but, of course, Bush and Cheney did close investigations on 9/11, and the perpetrators are still walking free, escaping our authority. I mean, they're trying to con us to murder millions of people. What a despicable individual. And really,
oh, yeah,
how could he possibly stand in the front of any man on this planet but for a censorship,
yeah,
right, to deny us these truths?
On the Chinese model, his rationale for putting a kill switch on the internet is they do it in China, so obviously it'd be a good thing to do here in the United States.
Yeah.
Yeah, Lieberman is an ambulatory pustule. I simply despise the guy in every way that is possible to despise him. He's despicable at a chromosomal level, and I suspect that in ways that transcend mere physiognomy, he resembles Senator Palpatine from Star Wars. He's a stone imperialist.
Yeah.
He's somebody,
yeah,
who,
right,
is statist, probably to the core of his contemptible being. And when you brought up the citizenship revocation issue, I think you really brushed up against the essence of what this guy is all about. He wants to remove any impediment on the government's ability to impose the will of the political class on the individual, on individuals, particularly those who belong to groups that Lieberman doesn't have to like.
Yeah, criminally, not to support following probable cause. That's what all these guys, you know, some people, you know, oh, you're against the Republicans. I'm against almost everybody in government who's not supporting following probable cause. You know, if we want to defend freedom, we want to get the actual bad guys. But they insist, no, you know, with censorship. You know, he's committed to incarcerating America. Oh, there's a guy, actually, just incidentally, I don't know all the details, but Wayne Madsen had talked about it today, about a Mr. Drake who had brought forward evidence that there are members of the Obama administration that are responsible for stealing literally billions of dollars from the American suckers, and instead of being rewarded as a true patriot warrior defending the American taxpayer, they've arrested him, you know, disclosing classified information that they're rooking us as crooks, thinking they're going to escape as the bad guys because we don't have any leadership on this level. And really, we are the level. This is where level heads prevail, where, again, if we had free communications here on CNN to go, look, what soldier supports the escape of 9/11 perpetrator,
yeah,
General Mahmoud Ahmad, who, according to the FBI, financed this thing? There ain't no soldiers going to speak in defense of escaping that individual. Similarly, like the KBR gang rapists that have gone unarrested, according to these 30 Republicans.
Oh, taking, yeah,
taking their formal,
yeah,
position at republicansforrape.org, where they've taken a formal position to say we're not going to arrest these guys, and there's another victim. You know, people go, there's no profit in laying blame for the past, as Obama said. That's almost a verbatim quote. Well, that is what justice is. We have to lay blame for past,
yeah,
grievance.
There has to be accountability on account of the fact that if you leave crime unpunished, you're rewarding crime and you're creating a state of moral hazard that's going to encourage more crime. And crimes of the sort we're describing right now are committed by the powerful. You probably heard Paul Craig Roberts talk about the fact that here in the United States, there are two classes of people. There are those whom the law doesn't restrain, and there are those whom the law doesn't protect. And this is particularly true of whistleblowers who are trying to bring about some kind of accountability with respect to people who are ensconced in positions of power and who can inflict their criminal nature upon the rest of us through this malign instrumentality that we call the state, I think that we've reached a point now where the only thing you can do that's likely to result in prosecution and attention of that sort from government is try to expose the crimes of the government.
Oh, for sure. Well, one of the first things Bush administration did, including Obama, is...
We're heading to a break here, John. Would you like to come back after the break?
Oh, for sure.
Okay, John's going to hold with us after the break. This is Will Grigg on the Pro Libertate radio program on the Liberty News Radio Network, 866-986-6397. We'll be back in just a minute. We're back here on Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. I believe we're still talking with John from Winnipeg. Are you still there, John?
Yes, I am.
Okay, we were talking about institutionalized criminality, which seems to be more or less a functional synonym for government here in the United States. But you were making a point, I believe, about the Bush administration or the first Bush administration or the Reagan administration before we had to go to break.
It's a ploy that they've repeatedly taken, but it started strongly with Bush after 9/11, where all FBI officers were told through PD, Presidential Directive 51, and W199I, that they would be risking arrest if they followed probable cause for the terrorist crimes of 9/11. And instead, what they showed on Fox News was there were Al-Qaeda terrorist cells all throughout America, thousands of them, top secret sources reveal, and we got to listen to all your phone calls, despite it being an illegal offense that Bush denied and yet later was found to be done. Similarly with torture, a crime warranting death, according to Reagan, and Bush said he didn't do it, but then again later, just like a couple weeks ago, said, I did. You know, they were confessions for criminal offenses while they close investigations, and again, the bad guys escape. It seems in some people's minds, this is too complicated, and yet it's really, really simple. You know, the FBI officers are not seeking probable cause, so everybody's a suspect now. You know, like in Arizona,
exactly.
They go, it's a police state for the immigrants. Well, now the cops don't need a reason to ask for your identification because, you know, you could be, who knows? You know, who's...
Well, it's not just a police state for immigrants, and it's not as if we're all mere criminal suspects, but post-911, as you know, post-911, we have suddenly the Northern Command... Basically, North America, it's not just the United States, it's also Canada, and it's also Mexico. It's basically the NAFTA nations or the would-be nations of this prospective North American Union configuration that's been discussed off and on for a decade or so. This suddenly is a military command, and implicitly, and I think in an increasingly overt way, you see this commingling of the military and law enforcement here treating that realm, the North American section, under North Command as an active battlefield. And one of the things that you see popping up all the time in the rhetoric of the Obama administration, it was very conspicuous during the Bush administration, but the Obama administration's followed seamlessly in this respect, as in others, is this idea that there really can't be a distinction between civilian domestic law enforcement and the tactics used on the battlefront when you're talking about prosecuting the so-called war on terrorism. And you made reference to torture or enhanced interrogation, to use the Nazi locution, the Nazi euphemism that gained currency during the Bush administration. You had Cheney and Bush, frankly, candidly, for public consumption on television and other electronic media, admit, after hemming and hawing and dissimulating for years, that they had done everything they were accused of doing in terms of ordering, mandating, ordaining the use of torture against terrorism suspects, both of them saying to do it again. And as you point out, that this is a serious felony, and under certain circumstances, under existing statutory law, it's a capital offense to commit torture or to order the use of torture. And you have the Obama administration running interference in a legal sense to try to protect everybody who was involved in this serious crime against American law and against the Constitution and the laws of nations, to use the phrase in the Constitution that's applicable here. But we're talking about, once again, the systematic removal of all the due process guarantees, all of the impediments on the exercise of state power against the individual. And it's gotten to the point now where as a matter of settled precedent and also mindset, the assumption is that whatever somebody who is acting under supposed government authority chooses to do to anybody else is legal and proportionate and right. And I think that that's one of the reasons why we're seeing this upsurge. It's, I think, not just a question of becoming more visible. I think it's actually an increase in casual police violence, criminal police violence against people in circumstances that don't justify that type of treatment. It's they're operating in an enabling environment. These people know that the dials have been preset here to assume impunity on the part of somebody who's in the job of enforcing the will of the political class, and the rest of us simply must submit. And anything other than immediate unqualified submission is taken as an aggressive act and grounds for summary street justice is administered by the state's armed enforcers.
Yeah, well, you know, we had, I can't remember what the total is, but I know it's a great many, it's probably somewhere near 20 prosecutors have left their job at Guantanamo, some with very great formal letters explaining that these are innocent people. You know, they've been randomly kidnapped off the deserts in Afghanistan. They've been tortured
for
and
money.
Expected to convict them with no evidence. Well, they say that they talk that far, but they don't go farther to go, look, we know that Bush and Condoleezza Rice with Cheney and Rumsfeld had a strategy to invade Afghanistan, again, a top-secret presidential directive strategy reported on by Jim Ekuchevsky at MSNBC 2 days prior to 9/11 on how to gain access into Afghanistan, and it was premised on blaming bin Laden, the terrorist, but giving no evidence against the accused. And as a consequence, they being Muslim fundamentalists who believe in God would defend an innocent man, considering he'd fought in the trenches against the dirty commies. And was, you know, as Ronald Reagan called him, one of the greatest freedom fighters of all history. But you look at the rules of engagement in World War II for the American military, and guess what? In World War II, the rules of engagement were death sentences against any soldier who would loot anybody, because that was the Nazi forces who would go into France and steal everybody's stuff and line them up in front of a ditch.
That
and
goes
now,
back
now they
deeply
say, well, what
to
happened
British
to that
common law.
Now it's top secret, but you can still get understandings where they're giving excuses. Everybody's got an excuse, like the police officer who gunned down the black man, shot him in the back. Well, you can't say he's innocent. You know, he's minimally criminally negligent, but from what I understand, they're letting him go on involuntary, was it voluntary manslaughter? If it's voluntary manslaughter, that means he planned to kill the person, so that's murder. Involuntary manslaughter would be an accident, so he wouldn't be guilty. I've never understood that in American jurisprudence.
Well, there are a lot of anomalies in American civil or criminal law with respect to gradations of illicit force like that. Look, John, we got to move on here. I've got to get on with the program, but it's always a delight to hear from you. And I think that things are probably going to get pretty dicey up on that side of the U.S.-Canadian border, too, so you stay safe, okay?
All right, buddy.
It's always good to hear from you.
Okay.
God bless you.
Okay.
Now, back on the subject here of the prospective war with Iran, I do think that it's worthwhile to look at one specific element of what Lieberman and the other two stooge senators were saying this week when they visited Israel. Lieberman said, once again, that a certain trumpet needs to be sounded here for the Iranian regime to hear. And then the next paragraph from this article from, I believe, the... Oh, it's today's Jerusalem Post. It's from today's Jerusalem Post. No, it's not. Forgive me. It's from 3 days ago. He said, meaning Lieberman, said the sanctions Congress recently passed against Iran were meant to signal to Tehran to, quote, negotiate the end of their nuclear program and reentry into the civilized world if that is possible. But if not, they should know that when Congress says it is unacceptable to get nuclear weapons, we mean it. We hope economic and diplomatic power will work. But if we must use force, that must remain a very active option. Let me unpack that here for just a second. First of all, I don't know by what metric Mr. Lieberman or anybody else from our degenerate political class could be recognized as a suitable spokesman for civilization of any sort. I mean, these people are not in the business of civilization. They're in the business of coercion. Civilization exists where people conduct their affairs through cooperation, through commerce, through negotiation, through peaceful collaboration, respecting on a reciprocal basis the rights of everybody else. That's certainly not what our political class does. Leaving that aside for the nonce, I want to know by what constitutional principle the Congress of the United States, the Senate, and or the House could be said to have jurisdiction over the military decisions of any other government on earth, whether you're talking about Israel, whether you're talking about Britain or Mexico, or in this case, Iran. Once again, this is what Lieberman said. They should know that when Congress says it is unacceptable to get nuclear weapons, we mean it. Well, you might mean it, but who the hell are you to say? You see, you're not part of the government of Iran. You don't have jurisdiction over that country. You don't have constitutional standing to dictate to them. And when you're usurping the authority to do so and demanding compliance, what you're doing is you're committing aggression. So what they're doing is they're trying to find some way, some semantic subterfuge, to disguise a blackmail threat, which is being enforced right now through economic warfare. That's what sanctions are. Sanctions involve compelled restraint of free trade, free private trade. That's an act of war. And we're talking once again about sanctions that include now, apparently as a result of concerted action, the denial of refueling rights for Iranian aircraft at certain airports throughout the Western world, Europe. That's the same kind of stuff that was being used as a prelude for war against Japan. And of course, that involved the triggering incident of the Pearl Harbor attack, which was brought about through the collaboration of FDR's regime and Yamamoto. Could we be facing a Pearl Harbor-like event with Iran? I wouldn't be surprised. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. We'll be back in just a minute. You know, if there is a war in the Middle East over Iran's refusal to accept dictation from the government of the United States regarding its nuclear energy program, and that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about the idea of vindicating through aggressive war the supposed authority of Washington to dictate to other nations with respect to their energy policies. But if there is this preemptive war, this would be the first of its kind in the Middle East, but there was actually an active proposal for a preemptive strike for the purpose of nuclear nonproliferation back in 1965. Very quickly, we do have a caller on the line. I want to read this because this is something that I think is historically relevant to what we're discussing right now. Some people are aware of the fact that in the build-up to the 1967 war, there was some concern on the part of Egypt over Israel's nuclear program. And Nasser, General Nasser, the ruler of Egypt, at one point had actually commissioned his general staff to write up plans for a decapitation strike against the Dimona nuclear reactor. This would have been exactly the same kind of thing that Israel did to Iraq in 1981, and for the same reason. This would have been a country engaged in a sort of protracted but unconsummated state of hostility, making sure that its rival didn't acquire a decisive military advantage and strategic advantage in the form of a nuclear weapon. There is a study on the abortive preemptive strike, which was published by U.S. Army Colonel Warner D. Farr. It was published as a study for the Air Force's Air War College, I think about 10 or 15 years ago. Referring to Nasser, Colonel Farr writes the following. His rhetoric of 1965 and 1966 about preventive war and Israeli nuclear weapons, coupled with overflights of the Dimona reactor, contributed to the tensions that led to the war in 1967. The Egyptian Air Force claims to have first overflown Dimona and recognized the existence of a nuclear reactor in 1965. The 50 American Hawk anti-aircraft missiles in Israeli hands half-ringed Dimona by 1965. Israel considered the Egyptian overflights of May 16, 1967 as possible pre-strike reconnaissance. One source lists such Egyptian overflights along with United Nations peacekeeper withdrawal and Egyptian troop movements into the Sinai as one of the three tripwires which would drive Israel to war in 1967. There was an Egyptian military plan to attack Dimona at the start of any war, but Nasser vetoed it. Farr continues, he believed Israel would have the bomb in 1968. Israel assembled two nuclear bombs and 10 days later went to war. Nasser's plan, if he had one, may have been to gain and consolidate territorial gains before Israel had a nuclear option. He was 2 weeks too late. And he was 2 weeks too late because Israel's air attack that reduced the Jordanian Air Force to rubble in a matter of minutes and wrought similar havoc on the Egyptian Air Force preemptive Nasser's planned preventative war. So they preempted the preventive war. They preempted the prevention, or they prevented the preemption. One way or another, Israel beat Egypt to the punch, but Egypt was prepared to do to Israel exactly the same kind of thing that Israel and the United States are planning to do against Iran. That is to say, Egypt, in the interest of nuclear nonproliferation, was going to take out the Dimona nuclear reactor, the same way that Israel in 1981 took out the Osirak reactor. Oh, some might complain, you're drawing a moral equivalence here. As a matter of fact, I am, because we're talking about acts not of defense, but of preemption. Preemption being a form of aggression. I don't think that there's any way you can deny that what Nasser planned to do and what Israel did were pretty much the same kind of thing. The difference here with respect to Iran is that in order to get after these facilities, which may or may not be devoted to the development of weaponized nuclear energy, in order to get at those facilities, you're talking about not merely a surgical strike, you're talking about a fully orbed military conflict against a country of 70 million people that has a fairly large and fairly well-appointed military and has, certainly in terms of the terrain and topography, a home field advantage. Anybody who studied Iran knows that Iran is pretty much all hills, and that, of course, means that there are certain advantages that come with the territory in terms of staging defense in depth against any kind of strike that could be contemplated here. Nonetheless, it seems as if the people in Washington and the people in Israel who are inclined to promote this idea of some kind of a U.S.-led imperium are planning for a war against Iran. And if this happens, a number of things are going to happen as well. The first of which is that what's left of the economy is going to crater. One of the reasons, according to Wayne Madsen and a couple of other sources I've read, why the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was willing to grant safety exemptions and to give BP, British Petroleum, which has a long and tangled history with Iranian energy interests, interestingly enough, to give BP a pass on many of the safety factors that contributed to the disaster unfolding in the Gulf right now, according to Wayne Madsen and his sources. One of the reasons is because the Obama administration wanted to increase production of that oil reserve in the event that it was necessary to fill up the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to compensate in some way for the reduction or the complete cutoff of oil coming through the Straits of Hormuz out of the Persian Gulf. As a result of the prospective war in the Persian Gulf, the Gulf of Mexico now is dying in a disaster that was in large measure, if these sources are accurate, and I think that they are at least plausible, in large measure we're dealing with a politically orchestrated disaster in the Gulf. That's one example of the blowback that we're dealing with now, and this war hasn't even begun. Another thing that's likely to happen, and Charlie Rangel, who really should have the decent shame never to appear in public again, quite frankly, given everything that has happened by way of exposing his corruption, Charlie Rangel once again stuck his head out of his hole like a Punxsutawney Phil and lectured the public about the supposed need to reinstate military servitude, to go back to the type of government-approved and government-practiced indentured slavery or servitude called the military draft. He's been beating on this drum now for the better part of a decade. And Mr. Rangel has actually proposed legislation to reinstate conscription. I don't think that would necessarily fly. But if it does, I think that we'd be likelier to see a return to conscription under a Democratic president than under a Republican one. Because I think that the Democrats would be able to find some pseudo-egalitarian way of packaging this, and the Republicans would be perfectly content to let the Democrats absorb the political blame for it. So we may have an alignment now congenial to a restoration of conscription. And what that means, of course, is that parents like myself are going to have to go on the lam. We're going to have to be living on the underground in some way or some shape or form, because there is no conceivable way I'm going to allow this government to have access to my kids. I have 6 children. All of the existing proposals for reinstating conscription are unisex in nature. They would draw from both male and female, and most of them would involve some kind of service option, working in so-called homeland security roles or in some other government-ordained function, or in the military. And you get better terms, of course, if you were to sign up to become a coffin stuffer than you would if you signed up to clean bedpans as part of the Obamacare army. But these are proposals that are in the wind right now. I've already gone public. I've already made it a matter of record that there is no way I'm going to permit the government to conscript my children. And I know that there are millions of other parents who have exactly the same views. Unfortunately, we don't have the option of merely going to Canada in order to avoid conscription, because after the end of the Vietnam War, and after, I think, as part of the amnesty arrangement that was put in place, there was an agreement negotiated with the Canadian government with respect to extraterritoriality on the part of people who were enforcing conscription. So I believe that under certain circumstances, Canadian authorities would be willing to collaborate in locating and forcibly extracting from their country people who have fled northward to avoid military servitude. Already, people who have gone to Canada as conscientious objectors to the Iraq War or the war in Afghanistan have found that they can't find refuge there. And so if we end up with a huge demand for military manpower because yet another front has been opened in this all-encompassing exercise of murderous stupidity called the Global War on Terror, or the Global War Against Bad People the government for right now doesn't control, in the event that there is the need for what they call surge capacity, that's actually in the literature, that phrase surge capacity, you're going to have some means of sucking people up and stuffing them into the war machine's gullet. And I honestly believe that that's a vivid and growing possibility, particularly now that the economy's taken the dive that it's taken. And even in the teeth of a bad economy, the military recruitment stats don't look promising, because people recognize that what's going on right now is consummately wrong. Thus ends hour one of Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. I'm sorry about our friend in Colorado. I hope he calls back in the next hour. And I hope to hear from you, too. So we'll be back in just a couple of minutes. So grab a non-intoxicating beverage, take a break, and join us in a couple of minutes, won't you? We'll be right back.